All right, I think we have a quorum. So, last time, I want to say thanks for the applause, but I do appreciate it, but let's please reserve the applause till the end of a week like a normal course. So, jumping into what I did last time, I think I left off in the middle of a sentence. Let me continue that sentence. Now, let me try to review what it was that I was doing last time. The big picture is the following. We want to stop attackers from attacking our data, from forgery, eavesdropping, etc. And how do we accomplish this? Well, there's one non-mathematical approach, which is to physically secure our network. Maybe I should emphasize that I'm talking about internet attackers here, people who are attacking our network using the fact that it's not at all physically secure, and one approach to protecting it is to physically secure it. Use a secure network, for example, a locked briefcase network, which unfortunately is rather expensive, but it does address the problem. This is an answer to how do we stop attackers from forging packets, how do we protect the secrecy and reliability of our information. Another approach, instead of using a secure locked briefcase network, is to use cryptography, so scramble our packets cryptographically, scramble our network packets in such a way that the attacker cannot figure out what the scrambled packets mean and cannot scramble a fake packet, cannot produce a forged packet in a way that the receiver will accept. And in order for this to run reasonably quickly, we want to build high-speed cryptography. Otherwise, the cryptography becomes unusable, at least for some number of users. This seems to be an obstacle, the fact that cryptography is too slow. So this course is about speeding it up. I neglected to issue a warning last time, let me insert that this time, that this is not the complete picture. Even if you have a secure network, either a secure locked briefcase network or a cryptographically secure network, even with a completely secure physical or virtual network, completely secure network, we are not stopping the attacker from modifying our information or reading our information because there's lots of software bugs. The attacker can exploit, for example, buffer overflows, which are just the foundation of a huge tower of software bugs. Even without buffer overflows, there are lots of software bugs. Other software bugs. In order to do the same damage that the attacker does by changing and reading internet packets, the attacker can read and modify and destroy your data. In fact, exactly the same classification of attacks, forgery, eavesdropping, traffic analysis, and denial of service can be applied to these other software bugs, and all of those are quite possible, all the way up to forgery, which is never acceptable, using, for instance, a buffer overflow. Read, modify, and destroy your data. Obviously, these bugs need to be fixed. Need to fix these bugs, along with cryptography. There's the software bugs inside a computer, and then there's the insecure network outside the computer, between the computers, and all of this needs to be fixed. For this course, this is not a general purpose security course. I'm just going to focus on the cryptographic side of things. This course will focus on cryptography, but of course there are other aspects of security which you need to address to completely stop the attacker. An example of these bugs, just a couple weeks ago, it was announced that Firefox, which has generally good security reputation, has actually several different buffer overflows, that if you're running any Firefox older than this month, then any attacker who controls a website a web page that you're looking at, or who forges a web page and sends that to you, can take over your Firefox, can exploit a certain buffer overflow and seize control of your computer, and then is at leisure to read and modify and destroy all of your data. So you have to upgrade to the latest Firefox, and I would not conjecture that the latest Firefox is secure either. This is not a recommendation to use Internet Explorer, which also is not secure, but there's lots of these software bugs out there, and there's very few programs which are seriously designed to avoid these bugs. Anyway, all that has to be fixed, plus the security problems in the network have to be fixed. Even if we fix all the software bugs, all the lazy programming, buffer overflows, and so on, we're still going to have radio networks. People are not going to pay for secure locked briefcase networks, so we need cryptography. And this course is about high-speed cryptography. Okay, last time I was getting into a specific example of a cryptographic function to quickly remind you what that function did. This is the bulk of the work in Rabin Williams signatures. This function is to compute, the function maps a number to its square root modulo n, given not just the input, the square of which we want the square root, but also given the factors of n, given p and q. And what are all these things? Well, p and q are primes. P is supposed to be a prime, which is congruent to 3 modulo 8. And then primes, there's also q, which is 7 mod 8. N is the product of p and q. You know the factorization of n into primes. And both p and q are about b bits, where you can interpret this in several different ways and won't affect anything that I'm saying. P is about 2 to the b. Q is about 2 to the b. So n is about 2 to the 2b. And was there anything else to say about the problem? I don't think so. I think I had a simple solution, which consisted of computing eth powers. So this is the basic algorithm. The result of the baby analysis of this original algorithm. If you compute square roots by computing eth powers, where I'll remind you of e in a few minutes, you compute an eth power modulo n. E was about the same size as n, about 2b bits. And that eth powering you do recursively by a sequence of about 2b multiplications modulo n. Then the time for this, if you use fast arithmetic at a lower level, use FFTs. Whoops. Use FFT-based multiplication. The total time for exponentiation was something essentially quadratic in b. It was time b squared times log b times log log b. And then you might ask whether this is optimal. Optimal question mark. Maybe it's optimal, maybe it's not. But in any case, that's as far as anybody's gotten with the baby analysis of the standard algorithm for computing square roots modulo p times q. Where I ended off last time was the Chinese remainder theorem speed up, which consisted of you compute square roots modulo n by computing square roots modulo p and square roots modulo q and recombining them. Last reminder, and then I'll continue with more serious analysis. This is the start of the serious analysis of the algorithm, the CRT speed up. Says that you compute square root mod n, instead of doing a powering modulo n, you compute square root modulo n as, well, you start from a square root modulo p, and then you add p times something to get the square root modulo n, square root mod p plus p times something mod q. And what is the something modulo q? Well, the something is, certainly this works modulo p, and to make this work modulo q, we need the dot, dot, dot to be p inverse modulo q, the reciprocal of p modulo q, something that if you multiply it by p, you get 1 mod q, p inverse times the square root mod q minus the square root we've already computed mod p. So this dot, 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 mod q, something between 0 and q minus 1, satisfies if you multiply it by p mod q, then you get the square root mod q minus the square root mod p. Adding that to square root mod p, you see that this is the right, well, some correct square root modulo q, assuming you subtracted the same square root mod p as you added there, then those cancel. And modulo p, this, of course, is also the right answer. So there's one explicit form of the Chinese remainder theorem. Why is this faster than computing the square root modulo n? Well, just as an example to illustrate what I was saying about the speed-ups last time, suppose that b is 512. B, the number of bits in p and q, is 512, which means that p, one of the primes, is about 2 to the 512, and the other one is also, q is about 2 to the 512. And n, the product of p and q, is about 2 to the 1024. E, the exponent that you take your square to the power of this e modulo n to get the square root, this was equal to p minus 1 q minus 1 plus 4 divided by 8. That's approximately 2 to the 1021. 1024 divided by 8 is 2 to the 1021. And then how long does it take to compute e powers modulo n versus computing square roots modulo p and q? Well, computing e powers when e has 1021, about 1024 bits, is about 1021 squarings. An e power is 1021 squarings and some number of extra multiplications, which depends on how many odd numbers you encounter in the recursion for computing e powers modulo n. Let's say on average, my approximate here will also be kind of vague, but on average over different choices of n, assuming reasonable conjectures for what n's of this p times q look like, there are approximately half of this number of squarings extra multiplications, so let's say about 510 multiplications, modulo this number n, which is a 1024-bit number. Compare that to computing a square root mod p and a square root mod q. A square root mod p is done instead of with an e power, which would work, you can do simply a p plus 1 over 4 power. Which is how many squarings? Well, p plus 1 is only about 2 to the 512 divided by 4, about 2 to the 510 squarings. And approximately, in some suitable sense, 255 multiplications modulo p, modulo a 512-bit number. Which is a lot faster. Now we also have to do the square root mod q. Which is another 510 squarings and another 255 multiplications, modulo another 512-bit number, namely q. Putting those together, it's about the same number of squarings and multiplications. The total is about, what is it, 510 plus 510 is 1020 squarings. And 255 plus 255 multiplications is 510 multiplications. But now, instead of being mod a 1024-bit number, it's mod a 512-bit number. And if you actually look in various cost models or on real computers, I'll get back to the issue of exactly what cost means, but if you look at the speed of 512-bit multiplication and division versus the speed of 1024-bit multiplication and division, it's more than twice as fast. You might initially expect it's as much as 4 times faster, and actually it's close to that. It's nearly 4 times faster. Although as the numbers get bigger and bigger and you use fast multiplication methods, the overall speed up converges to 2. Asymptotically, the speed up, asymptotically, you save a factor of 2 plus little o of 1, which the baby analysis cannot see because one of the critical simplifications in a baby algorithms course, a baby algorithms analysis, is that you ignore constant factors, and 2 or 4 or whatever number in between is a constant or bounded by a constant factor. So this is not visible to a baby algorithm analysis. Another example of a well-known speedup that is just a constant factor speedup, but very important. People pay attention to these factors of 2, especially if you've got a lot of them, or even factors of 1.1. Let's see another of these speedups called the windowing speedup. I should give some credit here. This is roughly due to Brouwer in 1939. Same Brouwer responsible for Brouwer groups, for those of you who are seeing some other topics here at the field. The windowing precise form of what people actually used was Thurber in 1973. What is this speedup? Well, it's another constant factor speedup, actually a little less than the 2 that I've been mentioning. It basically gets rid of the extra multiplications here, and, well, it doesn't get rid of all of them. What exactly does it do? Instead of the recursion that I told you before for computing i-th powers, where you compute a 2i-th power as the square of an i-th power and compute a 2i plus 1 power from the 2i power, let's do things a little bit differently. Use the recursive formulas. I'm going to suppress all the mod n's here and just work with an element of z mod n or z mod p or whatever you're trying to compute powers of. Use the following recursive formulas for computing the i-th power of h. Well, you start from some simple base cases like h to the 0, h to the 1, and then the typical case is h to the 2i, you compute just as before, h to the I and square it. For example, mod n, start from h to the I mod n, square it, reduce the result mod n. If you want to compute an odd power, you split into several different cases. And one of them is also the same as before, h to the 8i plus 1, you compute by first computing h to the 8i, which obviously boils down to the previous case of doubling an exponent. H to the 8i times h is h to the 8i plus 1. Where the formulas differ is h to the 8i plus 3, which you don't compute from h to the 8i plus 2 and h to the 4i plus 1. You start from the same h to the 8i and multiply by h cubed. And similarly, h to the 8i plus 5 and h to the 8i plus 7, you start from h to the 8i and multiply by h to the 5th, and h to the 8i plus 7, you compute as h to the 8i times h to the 7th. If you have a big power I, then you start by computing h and h squared and cubed 5th, 7th, and then all of these h cubed 5th, 7th inside the recursion don't involve any extra powerings. You remember h cubed, h to the 5th, h to the 7th, and then multiply them as selected by these formulas, by h to the 8i, which you compute with a few squarings. For instance, h to the 8i plus 7, you get with one multiplication of h to the 7th. If there's lots of i's, big i's to look at, then h to the 7th is computed only once. So there's just one multiplication of h to the 8i by h to the 7th. H to the 8i is obtained from h to the 4i, 2i, i, which is a total of 3 squarings and one extra multiplication. Compared to what did we do before, the previous formulas for h to the 8i plus 7, we're computing h to the 8i plus 6 via h to the 4i plus 3, via h to the 4i plus 2, via h to the 2i plus 1, via h to the 2i, via h to the i, which is 3 squarings and 3 extra multiplications. Here there's 3 squarings and 1 extra multiplication. Obviously, faster. Now, what Brouwer suggested was almost the same as this, but with one slowdown and one important speed up. The slowdown was, instead of just using odd exponents, he also stuck in even exponents, h to the 8i plus 2, h to the 8i plus 4, etc., with the second kinds of formulas instead of the first, and Thurber suggested not doing that. The speed up that Brouwer is responsible for is increasing the 8 to balance the time for computing these h cubed, h to the 5th, h to the 7th against the time for doing the typical cases of big i's. Instead of using 8 here, you can mechanically change the 8 to, say, 16, and then have h cubed, h to the 5th, h to the 7th, 9, 11, 13, 15, or whatever number you want. And in general, you replace 8 by something like, here's an easy-to-remember formula, b, the number of bits in your exponents, divided by the square of log b. LG, as usual, log base 2 of B, square it, divide it into B, take some nearby power of 2, and that's a good replacement for the 8. And now, how long does it take to compute I's powers? Well, it's easy to see the number of squarings always ends up being the number of bits in your exponent. If you use these windowing type formulas with the adaptation generalization of 8 to whatever number, some power of 2 doesn't even have to be a power of 2, but powers of 2 are easiest, some power of 2 close to b over the square of log b, then compute, I should have said approximately b over log b squared, then computing a b-bit power takes how many squarings, something like b squarings, and how many extra multiplications? Well, first you have to compute h, h cubed, fifth, seventh, that's something like 8 initial multiplications, a little bit less because you can skip some of the even numbers in there. In general, it's something like b over log b squared extra multiplications at the beginning. Plus, in your typical recursion, you have for some number like 8i plus 5, you have, say, 3 squarings and 1 extra multiplication. What's the ratio between the number of multiplications and the number of squarings? It's about the log of this 8. There's about 3 squarings, 1 multiplication. The 3 is from log base 2 of 8. And in general, you'll have log of that b over log b squared, which is about log b. The total number of multiplications ends up being about b divided by log b. Let me make a precise statement here. Big O of b log b, less than or equal to some constant times b log b, extra multiplications. If you change the b over log b squared here to anything in a pretty big range, say b over log b, then that still gives the same result here. If you have something even considerably smaller than this, it also gives the same result, b over log b cubed. Ends up with the same order of b log b extra multiplications. This b over log b squared is roughly optimal. You can optimize it more precisely, as Thurber did, along with suggesting using odd numbers in the way shown here, which is about the best formulas we have. All right, that's the time for computing a b-bit power. How does this compare to what I said before? Compare to the easy recursion, the 2i plus 1 recursion, where you don't optimize this 8, you boil it down to 2, the simplest case. And in that case, we were using b squarings, for instance, 510 squarings, for computing a 510-bit power, and about half of b multiplications. Every time you bump into an odd number, 2i plus 1, you need a multiplication. Something like half of b. Let me make a precise statement here. It's about b over 2 extra multiplications for an average exponent. Let me be precise, an average uniform random exponent. Average here meaning that I'm averaging the number of multiplications to get something like b plus 1 over 2. Uniform random. Uniform means that every exponent is equally likely, which is not exactly the case, but close enough. The exponents we actually look at behave randomly enough that they have something like half of b extra multiplications. It would be quite unusual to have an exponent where it's much less than b over 2 or much more than b over 2. The maximum would be b, the minimum 0. On average, it's about b over 2, which is a lot worse than b over log b. What's the speed up here? Well, as b goes to infinity, you can see that the total number of multiplications has dropped from 3b over 2, b plus b over 2, down to basically b. As b goes to infinity, the number of multiplications, the total of the squarings plus multiplications, number of squarings and multiplications, which you might think is not the right way to measure this, I'll get back to that in a moment, the number of squarings plus multiplications drops by a factor of 3 halves, approximately, 3 halves plus little o of 1. To be more precise, what I mean by approximately, cross out the approximately, this is on average. Drops by a factor of 3 halves plus little o of 1. Again, a constant factor speed up, something which put together with the previous 2 plus little o of 1 gives us about a 3 times speed up. Well, the previous 2 plus little o of 1 is for small numbers bigger than 2. This 3 halves plus little o of 1 is for small numbers a little less than 3 halves. Overall, the speed up is maybe 3 or 4. In any case, it's some constant factor, converges to 3 as your b goes to infinity. I said you might not think squarings plus multiplications is reasonable because squarings are easily sped up to be faster than multiplications. And that makes the speed up here even more impressive because we're reducing the expensive operations, the multiplications. We're chopping out a ton of multiplications. We're reducing b over 2 down to, say, b over 4, b over something that converges to infinity. B over log b converges slowly. Log b converges slowly to infinity. B over log b is much, much smaller than b over 2. So we're actually reducing the expensive operations. And in practice, that means the 3 halves should be replaced by a bigger number. But to say what that bigger number is, I would have to look at how fast squarings are and how fast multiplications are, which I will do, but not today. All right, so that is the windowing speed up, yet another constant factor improvement. And I could go on like this for a while, but this is all supposed to be for today, for this morning. I'm still doing introductory, what is this course about? And let me just say on this next pane of the blackboard that there are many more constant factor speed-ups these two very familiar speed-ups being typical examples. For example, just a list of a few of the speed-ups that you can apply to this algorithm, and if I have enough time at the end, I will go through all of these. I will be certainly doing the most important ones on this list. When you do divisions by n, at some point you compute a product mod n, which with fast arithmetic you do by first computing a product and then dividing it by n. How do you divide by n? Well, the fast algorithms for that start by computing a reciprocal of n and then multiplying by it. Reciprocal meaning an approximate real number reciprocal, or if you prefer, an approximate two-adic reciprocal. That reciprocal of 1 over n is something that you don't have to recompute every time you're dividing a number by n. And we're doing many multiplications modulo n, which means that we can save the 1 over n. Pre-computing 1 over n instead of computing it every time you divide by n. Another example of a similar speed-up is what's called FFT caching, which is another example of you look at your algorithm and you observe that you are doing many operations like FFT, fast Fourier transform, and often the inputs are repeated. And it's silly to apply this transform, whatever it is, to the same input more than once. And whenever you see the same input being fed to the FFT or any other operation, save the result in case you need it later. And that caching, well, includes this caching of 1 over n and lots of other examples of simply stare at your computation and notice that you are computing the same thing twice. A good optimizing compiler will notice this type of thing without your even having to think about it. But then there's more speedups, which are not of this flavor. For example, merging bit operations. If you look at a real computer today, then you notice that it's, say, a 32-bit or 64-bit computer, which has many different meanings, but one of the most important meanings is that these computers do 32 or 64 operations in parallel. It's very important to take advantage of that speed-up. This is something which, in some cases, can give you as much as a 32-time speed-up, simply paying attention to the fact that you have a parallel computer doing, say, 64 operations at the same time. An even more extreme speed up along the same lines is using fast floating point arithmetic, which is another example of staring at the actual computers that you have and saying, all right, what do they do quickly? Not just 32 operations at once, but a floating point multiplier will typically be doing thousands of bit operations at the same speed as doing what you might expect, say, 32 or 64 operations to be done at. If you look at a computer and you see what it does quickly, then you can exploit that in your higher level computations. I have this feeling that I've got two more things on my list. Let me just peek at my notes here and see what else I'd written down. Yes, I neglected to mention after FFT caching, another high level speed up was using remainders modulo something. Pause for a question. A computer operates on 32-bit words. I'm not making a subtle statement here about what's going on with bit operations. I'm simply saying that, yes, a computer is operating on, well, the maximum today would be a 128-bit word that you can get your computer to operate on in one instruction, one operation, which is as fast as doing a single-bit operation. I'm not trying to say that you have a dual-core or four-core processor, which is another type of speed-up. I'm talking about the most basic level of parallelism, that if you look at your computer, it is doing many parallel operations at the same time. And thinking about that parallelism is one of the important ways to get constant factor speed-ups in your computation. Floating-point arithmetic is a more complicated example of look at what your computer does, look at what it does quickly, which is typically many things in parallel, and then try to map your operations to those things. I'll be going through how you do this in considerable detail, how you take advantage of how computers actually work. But yeah, when I'm saying bit operations here, to answer your question, I'm just talking about the fact that a computer is doing many, say, 32 or 64 operations at the same time. There are many other levels of parallelism, and I'll be talking about those in this course, but the general principle I want to extract for the moment is look at what your computer does, and that will give you constant factor speedups. Another example which is independent of the computer is computing a remainder. When you're doing a remainder modulo n, you, let me, for sanity of this list, insert that in there after FFT caching, is computing remainders mod n mod something. I'll put a big X there, and the choice of X is actually something that you can optimize quite carefully. This might sound rather strange, what does mod X have to do with anything, but there is an important speedup that works this way, which is just, okay, how can we do arithmetic most efficiently? If you think about doing arithmetic using what people say is going to give you b squared log b log log b, then that doesn't include constant factor speedups like this mod computing remainders mod something else trick. Another example, I've already forgotten what the very last piece on my list was. Communication costs. Along with parallelism, inside your computer, your computations are slowed down dramatically by the time to communicate results from one place to another, and optimizing that communication, just like optimizing your use of parallel operations, is one of the most important ways to save a constant factor in your runtime, etc. Actually, a current theme of the cryptographic research literature, the SHARCS series of conferences, is that the communication cost speedup is more, and the parallelism speedup is more than a constant factor, but at least for the model of computation that you see in an algorithms course, like a baby algorithms course or this one, these are constant factor speedups. All right, I'm going to be going through quite a few of these speedups, and for the moment, I guess all I have to say is that when you put these together, then you get a huge speedup. I've already shown you, just with some simple, well-known techniques, how you get a factor of, say, 3 asymptotically, and you put that together with lots more tricks, and you can get easily a factor of 10 or more in your computation time. All right, you might object to all of this. Before I do the objection, let me emphasize that some of these depend on the machine. Some of these constant factor speedups are things that are machine independent, but some of them really depend on the fact that you have, say, a computer with floating point arithmetic in it. Your computer's designed for video games or weather simulations or something that leads the designers to put fast floating point arithmetic into the processor, build a big circuit that does floating point and put it into the processor for you, and in that case you can exploit that for fast arithmetic. Many of these speedups, certainly not all of them, but quite a noticeable number, depend on your machine. which creates a problem for a mathematician or computer scientist or real-world user who is trying to figure out what the costs actually are, what the constants actually are, is, okay, how do we measure these speedups? Well, the answer depends to some extent on what the machine is, which means you have to look at your machine. To measure, to understand your costs, and to see these constant factor speedups, you need to specify a machine . And at this point, you have many plausible choices of your machine. I'm going to be focusing on a few typical processors through this course. There are many other choices of what you'll see. Many other choices of cost measures which see constant factors and which are much more detailed than what you see in a baby algorithms course. You might object to all of this, a typical comment in a baby algorithms course is we don't look at constant factors because we can't look at constant factors. And people will say that the baby cop-out to say, oh boy, I don't want to define a machine, I don't want to look at some concrete model of computation, is you say, well, this is too much work, you can't do this, you can't define a machine, you can't mathematically model computation at the level of detail that would let you see constant factors. So you say that's too hard. We're only going to study algorithms at a machine independent level. Don't define the machine. And because of this, defining the machine being something difficult, because studying real-world performance or any other concrete cost model is too difficult, we skip defining it and we simply abstractly say there are some sorts of basic operations that go at some constant factor speeds. Don't study constants, because you can't study constants if you're not willing to do the work of defining a machine. And that also means when you're looking at big O, big theta, ignoring constant factors, then you can't look at any concrete size of B. You can't plug in, say, B equals 512. You have to look at asymptotics as B goes to infinity. Any particular fixed B, if B does not go to infinity, then your time is always something tiny. If B is big O of 1, then your time is big O of 1. Unlike a baby algorithms course, this course will pay attention to constants. I don't have to erase this yet because I have lots of space up there. Okay, good. What is next on my list of things to do? Right, so some of you might have seen this type of analysis, constant factor analysis, in other courses. And I would like to get an idea. I imagine there will be more variability at this point. Other constant factor courses. One example is architecture. This is often early in a computer science curriculum where you study how machines operate, at least at some level of, okay, how fast are instructions. Has anybody here had a computer architecture course? All right, I see some people who've raised their hands, many people who've not. If you've had an architecture course, you've probably studied constants. You've probably seen things like, well, here's an operation that takes one cycle, like doing something to a register. Here's an operation that takes 100 cycles, like accessing RAM. Another constant factor course would be, of course, an assembly language course, where it's possible to do this type of course without looking at constants, but very typically people will say, okay, a multiplication is 3 times slower than an addition, or 10 times slower, and that type of information is a constant factor study. And here again, I'm curious, how many people have had assembly language either as a course or self-study? Okay, small number of hands. And again, most people have not. These are not prerequisites. What's next on my list? Supercomputing. Which again is a constant factor course, at least for a typical size of supercomputer. Again, a current research theme is that supercomputers give you more than a constant factor, even more than a linear factor speed up, contradicting what you might have read. In any case, a supercomputing course will typically look at least at constants. It'll study exactly how long something takes and then try to improve that by, say, a factor of two. People will be very happy in supercomputing. And let me once again ask, how many people have had supercomputing courses, high-performance computing? Only one, two people, and again, most people have not had this. And as usual, when I make a list, I have this awful feeling that I've left something off the list, which is, yes, how could I have forgotten compiler design? Improving compilers, optimizing compilers. Another typical computer science course is figuring out how do you write a compiler, which is not too hard if you just want to make a compiler that takes C or a simplified subset of C and produces assembly language. But if you want it to optimize, if you want it to really speed up the output code, then you end up studying constant factors for how fast does your code run. And all right, I promise this will be the last question. How many people here have seen compiler design? Just a couple people. And again, my assumption is that this is new to most people. These are not prerequisites. I will be introducing everything that I need to say about constant factors, even down to the machine level, from scratch. The course will be self-contained as regards constant factor optimization, both at the high level and at the low level. I assume you have had an algorithms course, a baby algorithms course, the idea of analyzing an algorithm, looking at one operation, the next operation, multiplying by the number of loops, figuring out roughly how fast something is to the big O level. I also assume that you're familiar with the idea of improving algorithms, looking for redundancies, ways you can reorganize computations to speed up algorithms at the big O level or the big theta level. But I'm not assuming that you've had any experience with constant factor analysis. You don't need previous constant factor experience. You will get a lot of that experience in this course. You don't need previous experience analyzing constant factors. However, I saw various subsets of people who have had some of these courses, and you will recognize that some of the things I talk about are shared between this course and those courses. All right. Is that everything I had to say about constant factors? Let's double check the notes once again. Right. I want to emphasize, again, there are some speedups here which are machine-dependent. There are also definitely quite a lot which are not machine-dependent, things like this factor of two for the CRT speedup. All speedups are good. Remember Google. Remember that what we're trying to do is save time for the end user. And the end user just wants the fastest cryptography. He doesn't care about some academic distinction between the speedups which are independent of the machine and the speedups that depend very much on the machine. He just wants the fastest computations. Remember Google. Remember the application. All right, I think that's it for the example of what we're doing in this course, which brings me to course contents and the summary of what's coming up starting, I believe, this afternoon. Before I get into that, any quick questions about the constant factor philosophy, anything I've done in this example, or the distinction between this course and a baby course? Okay, no particular questions. So, course content. It actually occurs to me, since I've spoken for 45 minutes and I need some water, I'm going to take a 5-minute break at this point. So let's be back at, by my watch, 11:51. Well, that means by that one, 11:53. All right, I'll see everybody in 5 minutes. Alrighty, continuing. The course contents are the following. Well, constant factors obviously are important, and you could ignore all this cryptographic stuff and go back to what you studied in your baby algorithms course. Typical baby algorithms course beyond ignoring constant factors is ignoring most of the computations people care about, but focusing on a few really important computations. A baby algorithms course focuses on a few critical computations, for example, a typical third, maybe as much as a half of a baby algorithms course would be just looking at sorting. One problem, how do you sort a bunch of numbers as quickly as possible? Slight variations of the problem depending what you're sorting, whether you want the output to be the sorted list, the sorted multi-set, or the permutation of the original set of numbers that gives you the sorted result. Another fancier computation, also very critical for lots of different computations, is shortest paths, graph computations. Generally, a typical baby algorithms course will look at several different graph computations. You can go back to those computations and practice your constant factor analysis by doing, for example, a constant factor analysis of sorting. You can easily do an entire course or more, several courses, studying exactly the same problems from a constant factor perspective. Studying constant factors, studying the exact cost in various machine models, even one machine model, it's an interesting problem to figure out the complexity of sorting, studying constant factors for these same problems. There's a famous series of books by Knuth called The Art of Computer Programming, which has an entire chapter, and in Knuth a chapter means hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages in many sections, an entire chapter on sorting. And he studies a lot of the constant factors here in a lot of different situations, sorting in memory, sorting on tape, lots of different algorithms which have different constant factor performance. To some extent, the speed-ups that he gets, the constant factor speed-ups, depend on the machine. To some extent, they don't. But his perspective, like the perspective of this course, is we want the fastest results. We don't want to throw away results just because they're machine-dependent, as some results are. This course will not be focusing on sorting or shortest path. This course will, as my introduction has suggested, focus on cryptography. This course, instead, focuses on the most important operations in cryptography, four fundamental cryptographic operations, crypto ops. The four here is not the same four as previously, where I had four types of attacks, traffic analysis, eavesdropping, denial of service, and forgery. The four here are four levels of protection against those attacks, which protect in different ways against the different attacks. The first level is using a long shared secret to protect against some of the attacks a long series of messages . Some names associated with this in case you want to do Google searches . This is information theoretic cryptography . One part of it is something that everybody who has had even the slightest exposure to cryptography has heard of, namely the one-time pad. But actually, the part that I find most interesting is more advanced than the one-time pad, still within information theoretic cryptography, what are called Wegman-Carter message authentication codes, MACs. I guess I can leave this down here, go back to empty board number 5. Topic number 2 is, all right, what if we don't have a long shared secret? We do have a long series of messages, but suppose we only have a short shared secret. Topic number 2 is expanding a short shared secret into a long shared secret. Expanding a short secret key, a short secret shared between the sender and receiver. That's what the shared refers to here. Expanding a short shared secret into a long shared secret. There are several names associated with this. The general topic is called cipher design. Specifically, secret key cipher design. Some people also talk about public key ciphers, but for this course, cipher means secret key cipher. In particular, there are block ciphers and there are stream ciphers. Where I will say without qualifying this statement at all, that block ciphers should only be used as stream ciphers. I'll get into exactly what these things are and talk about it in considerable detail, I believe, on Friday, although my schedule for this week is not completely fixed in my head yet. So that's topic number two, is taking a short shared secret, a short secret that the sender and receiver know, and expanding it into a long shared secret, which then can be combined with protection number one. The long shared secret that you get as a result will then protect a long series of messages against forgery and against eavesdropping. Topic number three is getting rid of the shared secret by sharing a secret, which you don't have in advance. Topic number three is sharing a secret, a short secret suitable for number two, sharing a short secret. Fun exercise, by the way, for non-English speakers and even to some extent for native English speakers, is to say the phrase sharing a short secret 10 times quickly. Sharing a short secret through a public conversation. This means that I can pick somebody in the audience, Tanya, for example, and have a public conversation with her. Suddenly she wakes up. Hi. Have a public conversation with her, which everybody in the room hears, and at the end of it, we end up with a shared secret that nobody else can figure out without having shared any secrets in advance. I could pick anybody in the room, not even knowing who it is, and have a public conversation with that person, and then at the end of it, end up with a short shared secret, which nobody else can figure out, conjecturally. And then that short secret is something that we can both, now that we have a short shared secret, we can expand it into a long shared secret, and then use that long shared secret in part number one here to protect a long series of messages against forgery and eavesdropping. We can now exchange any amount of secret data, and not just secret, but we can protect it against forgery. We can make sure that nobody else can interfere with our communication. Even we can go to different sides of the universe and continue communicating through an insecure radio network, and nobody can interfere with that communication. The general names for part three here, if you want to do Google searches, are public key exchange, public key cryptography generally, and in particular the Diffie-Hellman system, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, hyperelliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, lots of flavors of this, of which I will focus on the fastest. And then finally, major course topic number four is protecting against forgery in a different way with no shared secrets. Topic number four is protecting a long series of messages. And here, let me emphasize that in number four, which is disconnected from one, two, and three, these are public messages, protecting a long series of public messages. With no shared secrets. Maybe I'll say without sharing secrets. One side, sometimes both sides of the communication, have their own secrets here, but there's never a shared secret, as in one, two, and the result of three. These systems, this is public key signatures. For example, the Rabin-Williams signature system that I have already mentioned is in major topic number four. I'll be going through these topics in order, roughly 1 and 2 this week, although getting into the constant factor analysis in 1, which we'll be able to reuse for 2, 3, and 4 to some extent, that is going to take enough time that 2 might spill over easily into the second week of the course after the number theory workshop. Topic number 3 and 4 will definitely be during that week. All right. For each of these critical internet security computations, what am I going to do? Well, let me emphasize, because it's something that if I'm going to sell these results to Google, then they want to know that these are useful for them, and these indeed are the critical computations, not the only computations that cryptographers care about, but these are the 4 most important computations for protecting network packets against forgery and eavesdropping. These are the critical internet security computations. And for each of them, I'm going to be doing 4 things. Another different 4 here. There's going to be 16 topics total, and I already have fewer than 16 sessions to do them in, but okay, we'll survive. For each of these operations, for each of these 4 operations, I'm going to be defining a state-of-the-art function that does that operation. I'm going to tell you 1 best, as far as we know, currently best method for topic number 1, a best method of protecting a long series of messages using a long shared secret, and similarly for 2, 3, and 4. We are going to see, we'll define a state-of-the-art function that carries out that operation. We're going to look at how fast that function is. Analyze the computation speed of the function, and then the extra time I'm going to have to take to discuss topic number 1 will be generally what does speed even mean from a mathematical perspective. What are these constant factors? What exactly are we trying to optimize in the speeds of these functions? What is the machine model? All right, after analyzing the computation speed of the function, or in some cases before analyzing the speed, I'll talk about security. Now, here we don't have thorough analyses, I suppose, for computation speed. There's also limits to how much we know, but for security, it's very clear in some of these cases that we have only partial understanding of the security of these functions. There's lots of conjectures that we don't have and for the foreseeable future won't have proofs for, but nevertheless, I will say what we do know about the security of these functions. Discuss the security of the state-of-the-art function, and consider alternatives. Some of the functions might seem weird until you look around at all the simpler, or not simpler, but alternative possibilities for the functions, and realize that those are not as good from a speed perspective or a security perspective. Again, I'm not going to be doing each of these 4 things necessarily in order, but I will be covering each of these 4 topics for each of the 4 critical cryptographic operations. What state-of-the-art functions are there? Well, for those of you who would like to do Google searches, is it time for me to move on to this board? I think it is. Here are the functions. For major topic number 1, using a long shared secret to protect a long series of messages, well, there's a part of it that you know already, namely the one-time pad, but the interesting part, the authentication part, the Wegman-Carter part, is called Poly1305. And this is a Wegman-Carter message authentication code, plus the standard part, the one-time pad. There are several different functions. In fact, there's something like 50 different functions in the literature that have various short names, like poly1305, that you could use for exactly this operation of protecting a long series of messages using a long shared secret. Some of them have security proofs, like poly1305. Some of them have reasonable security conjectures. All of them have at least very good reasons for being believed to be secure. And then they have a wide variety of speeds. Poly1305 and a couple of other functions are distinguished from the rest in being much, much, much faster, something like twice as fast as any of the competition. There are a couple of other functions, along with poly1305, that are competitive that I could use instead of poly1305 here. The other functions, UMAC and VMAC, are better than poly1305 if you are using a long shared secret to protect a long series of long messages on a Pentium 4. Those functions are particularly optimized for the Pentium 4, and particularly optimized for long messages, and sometimes you are in exactly that situation, in which case it's better to use UMAC than to use poly1305. But if you're in any other situation, if you want consistently good performance, something that does not become much slower for short messages or a variety of different processors that people have, then you should use poly1305. So I've chosen that as the state-of-the-art function for topic number one. This, for those of you who want to look it up, either through Google or through Springer, poly1305 was published in FSE Fast Software Encryption, one of the second-tier cryptographic conferences, in 2005. For topic number two, what was topic number two? Topic number two was cipher design, expanding a short shared secret into a long shared secret. For stream ciphers, there are many, many good possibilities. Block ciphers, there are many good possibilities. The last time that I've told people about these topics, I focused on AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, the world's most popular block cipher. When used properly, it's the world's most popular stream cipher. However, there is a new generation of stream ciphers that are considerably faster than AES, and in many cases have stronger security conjectures than AES. I will be discussing some of the problems from a security perspective and a speed perspective with AES. And as my state-of-the-art function, I'm going to choose SALSA 20. This is a stream cipher whose credentials and publication date are that this is in the eStream project, which I'll say more about in a little while before finishing today, hopefully before finishing today. This is in the eStream project, the eCrypt stream cipher project. This is one of the focus phase two ciphers. There's some other possibilities here, again, for stream ciphers. There's lots of fast choices. This is one that I like for reasons that will be very clear in a few minutes. Then for topic number three, sharing a short secret through Diffie-Hellman, through a public conversation, I'm going to be using Curve 25519, which, as the name suggests, uses curves, specifically elliptic curves. This is an elliptic curve, ECDH, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman function, which appeared in PKC 2006. This one is, except for a little bit of competition, which Tanya very much wants me to mention, except for a little bit of competition, this is twice as fast, at least, as any of the alternatives, typically three or more times faster. There's, again, a huge zoo of Diffie-Hellman possibilities. Out of all the different functions I could have chosen, Curve 25519 is, except for a little bit of competition, by far the fastest. The little bit of competition is hyperelliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which I just announced at ECC that I've gotten better speeds from hyperelliptic curves than Curve 25519 for elliptic curves. So there's hope of getting better results. There's a security problem right now, which will be fixed in finding secure parameters for the hyperelliptic curves, but it's clear that within a few years we will have better speeds from hyperelliptic curves. If I have time in this course, I would like to tell you about the hyperelliptic curves, but there's enough extra complication in the mathematics there that I will, for my selected state-of-the-art function, which also avoids the security problems, I will select curve25519 as my state-of-the-art function while mentioning that, okay, we have prospects of doing better in the future. So we will see some elliptic curve cryptography. And then for topic number 4, I'm going to be looking at classic RSA Raven-Williams signatures, RSA Raven-Williams SIGs, and in particular, various specific decisions here are encoded in square 2048. Which makes various concrete choices of how you do Raven-Williams signatures to optimize the speed as much as possible without compromising the security. Although most of the ideas here go back to Raven and Williams. Particularly Raven's 1979 tech report has a ton of useful information in it and anticipates pretty much everything that's happened in the public key signature area in the subsequent 25, 27 years. All right, beyond the speed reasons, yes, I should say that the speed for square 2048, in general, for any competent implementation of Raven-Williams, you will get much faster signature verification than you do with any of the alternative non-RSA-type signature systems. For example, you could use elliptic curves to sign messages, but if you do that, your verification speeds are quite a lot slower than the verification speed for these RSA-type signatures. In the context of situation number 4, when you have lots of public messages that you're broadcasting to lots of people, the more recipients there are, the more people have to verify your messages, whereas signatures happen only once. And that means that in topic number 4, for operation number 4, we will measure functions according to their verification speed as the primary concern. And then there's more concerns like the size of the signatures, the size of the public keys, which balance the situation somewhat. I'll get into all the efficiency issues as part of topic number 4. In any case, the particular feature of Raven-type signatures, RSA actually didn't have the critical improvements. Raven had a lot of critical improvements and then further improvements by Williams. Any Raven-type signature system has spectacularly fast verification, and I'll show you the latest speed-ups which make it even more faster, well, very, very, very fast for signature verification. That's what suggests using these systems. The concrete choices in Square 2048 versus the other Raven-type systems out there, well, there's many reasonable choices here, but they all follow the Raven-Williams framework. Okay, so those are the functions that I have chosen for speed reasons. Now, some people might think I've chosen these for other reasons, which is that all of these functions are ones that I've defined. The curve 25519 function and software is something I wrote, Poly 1305 function and software, and Salsa 20 is my own submission to eStream, and Square 2048 is my own Raven-Williams software. Not that I'm biased or anything, really. My reason for choosing these functions, well, the reason I was getting into defining these functions and implementing them is that they are the speed leaders. These are the fastest functions for the security levels that users want for, say, 128-bit security. These are functions which all have solid security conjectures and, in some cases, proofs, and they are the fastest functions that I'm able to come up with. Now, if people can come up with faster functions, I'll be happy to switch, but I'm also comfortable with these as being quite representative of the state of the art. Again, keep in mind there are alternatives, but I will, as part of my survey of alternatives, try to indicate why I've made the various choices that I did in these cases. I can certainly say comfortably to users that, all right, these will give you very good performance in all situations, and other functions out there are not giving you as good performance. All right, that's all I want to say about course contents. And then I have a little bit of an interlude about course projects, which hopefully will fit in the next 15 minutes, and then it might slip over a little bit, in which case I'll do that this afternoon, and then jump into topic number 1, specifically Poly 1305, starting this afternoon. Before I do the course project summary, any questions about the scope of the course, the outline here, what we're going to be doing? Yeah. Is there an, sorry, say again? Is there a key size? Well, roughly these are all aiming for 128-bit security, which is a little tricky in case number 4 to say what security actually means. But all of these, Poly 1305 has a security guarantee, which is on the scale of you have to do something like, if you do one forgery attempt, then you have something like a 2 to the minus 100 something chance of success. And then you could do many forgery attempts. There's lots of factors that modify what's going on, but it's basically 100 something bits of security. SALSA 20 actually aims for higher levels of security. I'll try to say why that's a good idea when I get to it, but at least 128 bits. Curve 25519 is the fastest attack we have, is something like 2 to the 128 bit operations, and for and also something in various other cost measures than bit operations, curve 25519 is 128 bits of conjectured security. And then for Raven Williams, I'm focusing on something which is 100 something bits of security, which again, here you have to be careful about your definition of the cost for the attacker. If you count bit operations versus counting price performance ratio, you get a very different notion of how fast the attacks are, because the attacks have a lot of communication costs. This is what the Sharks workshops are about, is figuring out how fast attacks really are if they're dominated by communication or if they're not, and trying to get a better idea of the cost of attacks. Anyway, subject to that question of how we measure attack difficulty, this is also at 100-something bit security level, which is comfortable for the users. I'll get into that actually starting this afternoon. I'll say a little bit about what users want in terms of security and how you choose key sizes for these systems. Then, subject to any particular key size, you can try to optimize speed. Of course, you can always make a system faster by scaling it down to a much smaller key size. Anything I say about speed records is relative to the security level or the conjectured security level. Certainly, if you're willing to accept some tiny level of security, which the attacker actually can break or might be able to break with a serious computation in a few years, then these are not the fastest functions. You can always make things faster by reducing the security level. Does that answer your question? Okay. More questions about the course outline? All right. This leaves me with 10 minutes to say something about the course project. Now, you are, of course, allowed to sit here without doing projects, but I should say, in case anybody is a student here or nearby or somewhere else who wants course credit, I believe Fields has some procedures for that. The person to ask is, I believe, Jason Wu. And if that's something that requires any feedback from me, any sort of grade, then that grade will be based on the course project. However, for everybody else, the course projects are simply how to make sure you really understand the course material. So, course projects. I would suggest that these projects, actually following through, doing some work, is the best way to make sure that you understand everything that's going on. And what exactly is the work I suggest you do? Best way to really learn the course material. Is to write some software, and not just any software, but write some software, cryptographic software, that sets new speed records. For those of you who are scared of computers and just want to understand the high levels of cryptography, sorry, the course projects are not for you. This requires programming experience to do the course project. I'll say more about the programming environment that I recommend and the programming strategies that I recommend later, but for today, just want to say what the objective is. If you really want to show not just me, but everybody, that you've set new speed records, the best way by far to do it is to publish the software, so that other people can download it and use it for other people to use. And in particular, other people would be, say, Google. Make Google, Yahoo, etc. And anybody who might be a user of cryptography, if they see new speed records for cryptography, then maybe that makes the cryptography usable for them in situations where it otherwise would not be usable. Now, you might look at this and object that this is something not a reasonable course project scope, that course projects are supposed to be redoing things that people have done before and not setting new speed records. So you might object to these course projects and say, wait a minute. I'm just starting out. Maybe a few people here, I know a few people here have done some high-speed cryptography, but the intended audience is people who are new at this game. I'm new at this, you might say. So can you really expect to fulfill these project requirements? Can I really expect to set new speed records? Answer, no, there's no hope. No, answer, yes. You can. It's actually quite a lot easier than you might think. And the reason that you should imagine this as being doable, and if you actually go through some reasonable amount of effort, then you will be setting new speed records, is that there's actually not too many people who are in this game. Don't overestimate the competition. Yes, there are thousands of papers that might all sound like they're about high-speed cryptography, but usually they're not about really, really high-speed cryptography. They just sound like they're about high-speed cryptography. They're proposing one improvement, another improvement, but very few papers are actually putting the improvements together and saying, okay, we have the fastest software by just doing everything sensibly and not making any mistakes. If you look at a typical piece of cryptographic software today, typical crypto software, then it's going to be some implementation of cryptography from, say, a few years ago, which then a few users said, hey, maybe you should speed it up like this. It will have some speed ups. But it's going to be missing many more. It misses most speedups. I like to compare the time for software, the upper bounds for how long a computation has to take, I like to compare that time to lower bounds for how long the computation has to take. In my mind, there's a perfect implementation of any particular function, and then the perfect implementation is something where, well, you come close to it by writing real software, but if you make one mistake, then suddenly your software becomes half the speed, twice as slow. And if you make, say there's 30 possible mistakes, you make 10 of those mistakes and your software is 1,000 times slower. Maybe it's not that extreme, but it means that if you write new software that makes fewer mistakes, you're going to have a new speed record. In fact, things are more compressed than that, that a typical piece of software that I see people actually using is going to be within, say, a factor of 10 of optimal. I see a suggestion to move the board up or to speed up. Move to the right board here and move that up. Ah, yes, instead of erasing. Thank you. Good idea. If you look at a typical piece of software, and at this point I actually wanted to do a computer display. Let me see if I can fire this up in Firefox, which, oops, is a little bit blurry here. Readjust projector screen. Don't mind the big gray thing in the middle. Readjust focus. There is no focus. Well, okay. Let's just fire up the browser. I just want to convince you here that it is reasonable to expect to speed up software, even really popular software. Like, let's say, what do web browsers use? Well, they use OpenSSL. And let me show you a graph that has OpenSSL performance. And the web page that I want is www.ecrypt.eu.org/ebats. And what is ebats? Well, I'll say more about that this afternoon. Running out of time for the morning, but let's see here. If you look at graph, then what do you find here? What do browsers use for doing their benchmarks. They use OpenSSL. Now, this is a graph. On the x-axis of the graph, let me see if I can make it any larger. On the x-axis of the graph, there are various machines. For instance, this cruncher on the left, Pentium 1 Model 52C, benchmarks done on the date 2006, no, benchmarks using software version 2006-0818 of some benchmarking software, the EBAT benchmarking software. And that Pentium 1, there's a graph that you can't see. What's on the vertical axis here? Well, there's number of clock cycles for doing one of the most basic cryptographic operations you might think of, 1024-bit modular exponentiation, computing a 1024-bit power mod, a 1024-bit prime. A million clock cycles, well, a Pentium 1, this particular machine cruncher is a 133 megahertz Pentium 1 that I have sitting in Chicago, whose only purpose in life is to run benchmarks, which it does very, very slowly. It's a 133 megahertz machine, which means it has 133 million clock cycles per second. A million clock cycles, well, that's 1/133rd of a second. That's something like 7 milliseconds. And then 2 million, 4 million, 8 million. This is a log scale of clock cycles. And here's some graphs for times to do a 1024-bit modular exponentiation. The y-coordinates there, 20, 30 million cycles, are the speeds of two different pieces of software on this cruncher computer, Pentium 1. And then different computers have, this is sorted by the green speeds here, different computers have got a PowerPC G4, the old Macintoshes, the old PowerPC chips. I've got a Pentium 4, an old Pentium 4 version F12, a newer Pentium 4, which has slightly different performance depending on the software, an UltraSpark 4, one of the latest Sparks you can get from Sun, an Athlon, one of the original Athlons, model 622, a newer PowerPC, the PowerPC G5 from IBM, where you can see the number of clock cycles drops considerably depending on which software you use. Green and red are different pieces of software for this computation, and one of them gets a lot slower on a PowerPC G5 compared to an Athlon. One of them gets a lot faster. Then there's an Athlon 64, one of the current favorite computers. I just did some Pentium Core, Intel Core 2 Duo benchmarks, but I haven't put them in here yet. Another version of an Athlon 64, almost exactly the same speeds. And then an Alpha, this is a 500 megahertz or so Alpha, very old chips, kind of like the Athlon 64, but, well, much lower clock speeds, much older, and at this point basically dead, but it's still interesting to do benchmarks on it. And so you can see the green lines there are, what was it, 1 million, 2 million, 4 million, 8 million. Depending on the computer, there's a lot of variability in clock cycles. But what I want to emphasize for now, and then I'll shut up for this morning, is the difference in software speeds, where the red speed here is the speed of OpenSSL, which is the standard library that all the browsers use, supposedly very much optimized, and that's the top graph here. Many more cycles, depending on the machine, here's a factor of, say, 1.5 speed up, that you get by simply switching from OpenSSL to GMP, the GNU multi-precision library. Simply doing exactly the same computation, the 1024-bit modular exponentiation, with verified same results from the GMP modular exponentiation, instead of OpenSSL, gives you, depending on the machine, this is, what, a factor of 4, 5 speed up, a factor of 1.5, a factor of 2, factor of 2. On a Pentium 4, which is certainly a typical current machine, not the latest machines out there, but there's a lot of Pentium 4s, and you would think people would optimize code for it, OpenSSL, depending on which version of the Pentium 4, is a factor of 2 slower than GMP for exactly the same computation. So if you have some notion of OpenSSL as being something really seriously optimized, and you couldn't possibly improve on it, this graph should disabuse you of that notion. This makes very clear that OpenSSL can be dramatically improved. Hey, here's a speed up in cryptography. Let's just get rid of OpenSSL's modular exponentiation and plug in GMP. But okay, I want you to do better than that, and I'll say more about the course project in the afternoon. So that's enough for this morning, and I will see everybody at 3:30.